Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another program in our ongoing coverage of the Casey Anthony trial. Joining me in the studio is my wife, Jan. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Simon. Hi, everyone.
And I do want to make it official. I have seen her driver's license. She is officially 25.
Happy birthday.
Trying to redeem yourself again, huh?
From his summer home in Upper New York, we have the crime doctor himself, Denny Griffin. Denny, welcome.
Hiya, Simon. Hi, everybody, and happy birthday, Jan.
Thank you, Denny.
And Denny obviously has more couth than I do. You know, he didn't make any jokes about her age.
He's a nice guy.
From the epicenter, Orlando, Florida, we have journalist Dave Neckel. Dave is one of the few press people that managed to secure a seat in the courtroom, and I'm sure that he will have a wealth of information that us mere video watchers have missed. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi, Simon and everyone else. How are you today?
I'm doing just great. Are you ready for another fun-packed week?
I am ready for another one. Yeah, that's the truth.
I am also very pleased that we have veteran trial lawyer Manny Barling with us. He has no dog in this fight, but he certainly understands the legal world. Manny, it is good to talk to you again.
Well, it's a pleasure to join this group. They're always so much fun.
Good Lord, your life must be incredibly boring.
Well, you know, I was so difficult pre-show, I thought I'd try and clean my act up a little.
And of course, we have our very good friend, bounty hunter. Oops, sorry, that's politically incorrect. Bail bondsman, William Cobra Storbs. Cobra, welcome to the program.
Hey, you can call me Jim, or you can call me Bounty Hunter. You can call me whatever you want. Hey, happy birthday out there, Jan, and be advised. With that intro that Simon put out, I think he's trying to get lucky. Really, really bad.
Do they have snowballs in the South?
But nonetheless, you guys have a happy birthday together.
Thank you.
You're welcome, welcome, yeah, welcome.
In Mississippi, we have something called no fault sex.
When did you learn how to play the saxophone?
Okay, on with the program. After almost 3 years, the trial is finally underway. Last Tuesday saw opening statements. The morning was taken up by Linda Drane Burdick for the prosecution, laying out their case. Did the prosecution do a good job? Dave, I believe you were there. Did they hit the mark?
Yeah, you know, that's one thing about Linda Drane Burdick. She's very predictable, and I don't mean that in any sort of way other than complimentary. I mean, what she did in a nutshell basically was give us a synopsis of from the day that Casey was arrested and until up to you know, the beginning of the trial. So she filled in some of the little cracks that we might have forgotten about. I mean, really what it was a real good introduction into, like, here's what's happened all this time. And I think she did a great job.
Jen, would you concur?
I thought she did a tremendous job. I mean, she was very calm, very plain. I mean, to the point of everything. I really think she covered it good.
Manny, you've spent more hours in courtrooms than should be legal.
I couldn't agree more.
Do you think the prosecution put on a pretty decent opening statement?
Oh, I think so, but, you know, I think that's really blown out of proportion. I think the reality is that it's not how they go through things. The question is, what are they saying that they can prove? And generally, that works better for the prosecution than it does for the defense, because the prosecution has a much easier case to prove, generally speaking. And so they have more to say, and they have the chronology. And this is where the benefit of having literally a fortune to spend on preparing your case shows up. Because one of the things that people forget in these cases is the prosecution can outspend the defense by, you know, 100-1 in terms of dollars. So this is an opportunity where you see that.
That is an interesting point. But in this particular case, Casey Anthony is indigent. Are you saying that the prosecution has access to more resources than the defense?
Well, that's as obvious as the sun rising. That's one of the problems with all cases, especially indigent cases. When you're in civil law, in fact, somebody asked me this question this morning. Can the other side afford to run one side into the ground financially litigating? And the female lawyer was worried about it because she was worried how it may impact her client. Well, in a criminal case, you go through the door knowing that the prosecution has an advantage of spending dramatically more and having more manpower and all of this. So as a result, they're able to just do things that the defense can't do. And that benefits them. And I'm not saying this is good, bad, or otherwise. It's just simply a fact of life.
Okay, we got slightly off base there. Cobra, do you think the prosecution did a good presentation?
I think, Dave said, there was a lot of crack filling going on, but. But the thing of it is, I think you can allege a whole lot of stuff. It's what can you prove? I mean,
right.
They're very eloquent in their opening statement. Very eloquent, very well laid out. I mean, I think they did a very good job. It read like a best-selling novel. However, I think in the upcoming days, it's going to be slightly difficult for them to actually prove what they've proffered. And secondly, in that same venue of showing it up, it also looked to me that right after they started opening statement and they called their case or whatever you call it, it looked like all of a sudden their respondents or their people started supporting more of the defense than they did. It looked like defense witnesses more than prosecution witnesses once it opened up. So I think they proffered a little more than they can prove.
Denny,
yes.
You're the thinker. You like to mull things over. Do you think the prosecution came out strong?
Yeah, I thought it was well organized, businesslike, if that's an accurate term. I felt. It was a good presentation by Ms. Burdick, and I didn't, hear anything that was a shock to me. I think there was some mention that perhaps the duct tape had been, in fact, the method of death through suffocation. That was new to me. I hadn't heard that before, at least publicly. But I thought it was a good opening.
All right, I'll weigh in. I thought the prosecution put on a pretty well argued opening statement. Now, obviously, they have to prove it. 150 minutes, I believe she spoke for, or yeah, give or take. Break for lunch, and then defense. Who would like to discuss it? I mean, I wasn't all that surprised at the content, but I was amazed at the veracity in which it was delivered. Dave, what are your thoughts?
Well, it was, you know, one of the interesting things is Sunday night I wrote something, and it didn't appear till like after midnight, so it looks like it was put up Monday, which technically it was. But I think I titled it "Drowning in a Pool of Lies," which is pretty much exactly what happened that, you know, the following day. And you know, the thing with Baez, he reminds me of a guy that would have a lot of money. Instead of having one $100 bill, he'd have 100 singles to make him look richer than he really is. And I think that's what he did with his opening statement. I think that it was shock and awe. That's what he tried to do there. What he really wanted to do was force the jury into thinking that, hey, maybe there's more to this than just a cut and dry, you know, murder trial. The father's involved now. That's pretty tough to forget about that sort of an accusation. I think that he was dreaming, because I don't see any way that he's going to tie George holding the dead baby to Kronk putting it into the woods. There's an awful lot missing there, and I don't think the defense is going to be able to prove anything other than somebody in that house, namely Casey, was responsible for that girl's death.
Quite the contrary.
What's that?
I say quite the, just stay tuned.
Yeah, right. Well, it's coming. I'll be there on Tuesday.
Okay, Cobra, you obviously have some thoughts, so wax lyrical.
Let me get my blood pressure medicine first.
Somebody better pop off some. So a little bit later in the show, as it goes on there, it gets a little more involved, and we all stick our necks closer to the guillotine. I have a quote coming forward from somebody who is on standby to be called as the next prosecution witness popping loose here, and it kind of fill in some of those blanks for you. But I think Baez did a pretty good job. There was no real shocker on any of the Anthony team, because they already knew where this was going, even though it appeared that, you know, some of the language and some of the things said were quite repulsive at times. But this is all part and partial to the strategy that they are adopting. And there's one key player that can make it all happen. And I think, Dave, you'll be shocked if you're going to be in that courtroom every day. I think one day you'll walk out of there and go, I'll be a son of a gun.
Well, I think there will be some moments like that for sure. But I find it hard to believe that George actually, you know, sexually abused his daughter. You know, that to me is quite... you know, I mean, look at it this way. What are the odds of there not just being one, you know, her brother, let's say, but not only was her brother trying to sexually attack her, so was her father. I mean, what are the odds of one person, let alone two, in the same family? You know, the odds are ridiculously low that you'd ever get that.
it's part of the defense strategy, and you know, I told you early on, and everybody thought that his opening statement was going to be all about Lee, but you have to understand, right now, Lee has a very good chance to come in and free this whole thing up and make it all go away. So they took one bite at the apple and multiplied it, and now they have three bites at this apple. You've just seen one bite, and I know the next bite, and I predict the third bite, but basically, at the last second, they changed their strategy slightly.
Oh, okay. Jen, were you surprised at the defense tactic?
Partially, yes. The part about George taking the baby out of the pool, and yeah, that part really threw me, because I don't believe for one minute that he would have took that baby out of that pool, held her in his arms, limp, dead, and yelled at Casey, asking her what did she do, and her mother will never forgive her. I'll never believe that as long as I live. I'll never believe that was his first thought. I think his first thought would have been to put her on the ground and try to give her CPR, if nothing else. And yell,
I agree.
Call 911.
Right, absolutely.
The first part of that, the dogs did hit on the ground right by the pool, so maybe that part works.
That's what I'm saying. I don't believe that he would have held that baby in his arms and yelled at her like he yelled in the courtroom that morning. I'll never believe that's what happened.
No, and I don't think there's much decomposition either when a person drowns. You pull that person out of the pool
right.
And put them on the ground, you know.
Right.
Besides that, why wouldn't he have taken her in the house and, called 911, like you said?
Well, at that moment, he would have, to me, if it would have been me, I'd have pulled the baby out, put her on the ground right there and tried to administer CPR to her and yell, go call 911. That
right, and who put her in the trunk? Who put that body in the trunk? Casey would get blamed for it.
Well, still, guys, you guys are assuming that within minutes, moments, or even an hour that he did this alleged maneuver. No one put a timeline on that. It may have been 4 days, 5 days later that he did that.
That's not the way he put it, though. I mean, he put it that was the day that Casey came home, and he seen Casey, what was it, the 16th? That's the day that he said that this all happened.
And not only that, Jan, but the defense came out now and stated that not only the prosecution thinks this, not only does George think this, but now the defense thinks this too, and they're preaching that she died on the 16th of June.
Exactly.
Admitting that.
That's what I'm saying. They said that it was on the 16th.
We need some clarification there because, not to interrupt you, Jan, but when he called 911 and told 911 that his gas cans were missing, he later on the stand said that he hadn't seen his daughter for 5 or 6 days. Then he showed up, and, of course, our favorite thing came in. Here's your fucking gas cans, which was used and used and used. It's the best thing I've ever heard in my life. But there was a 5-6 day period there. And I think somewhere in it, and I say if you watch very closely, both sides are able to manipulate exactly the answers that they want. And the timelines all of a sudden become a little blurry. At least they did for me when I was...
Well, actually, it was the same day, Cobra. It was the 24th that he called 911, and it was later that day when Casey drove up. She didn't know her father was there, you know, because
right.
The garage door, I guess, was closed. That's how he heard her coming in. And then she had one of those, uh-oh, he's home. And
but he hadn't seen her for 5 days.
Well, the last time he saw her up to that point was the 16th. So it's more than 5 days. It was 9 days, or 8 days.
I just know what he said.
See, I think it is, the discrepancy in all this, I think it is that he's trying very hard not to lie, but yet he's getting confused and he's trying to protect her at the same time and yet not put the finger on him. I think that they're deliberately trying. Well, I know Baez was deliberately trying to confuse the man, and they was also probably confusing the jury as well.
I want to ask Manny a question, and It's more of a legal strategy question. Do you think that Baez overplayed his hand in the opening statements?
Well, I don't think he has any other plan to do. I mean, really, sometimes lawyers will sit there and reserve opening statement because they have some valuable thing that they want to wait to do later on, but he can't preserve anything. And, you know, we started out with Dave's comment about, you know, it was going to be a pack of lies or speech of lies. I don't remember your exact words, and I'm not criticizing it. But that's exactly what you're going to get in this type of case because you're coming through the door with someone who's accused of a crime, and you're forced to try and find some other solution than the fact that she may have done it, when in fact she may have done it, and you know that, and you're trying to figure out what can I say that will allow me to put on some kind of defense. And believe me, it's not easy to do. So, you know, here you got basically the prosecutor who can take the high road every time and basically look good to everybody because that goes with the program. But in the case of the defense, whatever he says is going to not ring true to anybody because he's essentially dealing with something that's probably not true. One of the fallacies of what I'm hearing is that these cases are solved in one day or you get answers in one day. It's a long, drawn-out process. So the beginning of every trial is confusing, even simple civil trials, because, you know, there's a tendency to want to tell the whole case in the beginning, immediately, so everybody gets it. But you can't do it. So you can only get out what you can get out with each witness. And it's sort of like putting together a jigsaw puzzle, and you got the corner together, and you go, well, the rest must look like this, or this can't be correct, or this part doesn't really fit. Well, most of this goes on because it's so early in the process that it leaves all these areas open. But time will tell, and time will resolve all these issues. And when you talk about confusing a jury or whatever, juries sort of go through the door knowing that it's going to take some while. They don't rush. They don't go, okay, the case was decided today. Instead, they go in chambers and they say things like, wow, I wonder what they're going to say next, or geez, you know, when are we supposed to start believing things? So they understand from jury instructions and from their own life experiences, they've just heard the tip of the iceberg. So basically what we are is discussing the tip of the iceberg, trying to figure out what all of us think is at the bottom of the iceberg when we get there. So that impacts a great deal of what you're listening to.
Well, you know, not to get back to this for a second, but, you know, I think when Linda Drane Burdick did her opening act there, you know, one of the things she put up was a picture of the last photograph, known photograph taken of Kaylee when she was alive. And then she mentioned that. And then side by side, she took that photograph with a photograph taken in the woods of her skull. So I think that had an awful lot of impact on that jury. But
well,
getting back to, yeah, I mean, I couldn't believe that we actually got to see it, but I think that's going to be something that's going to be in the minds of those jurors more than something that would be. It's going to be with George, for example, with Baez said, it's going to be a case of he said, she said, you know, about the sexual molestation. But,
well,
you know.
Right. But wait a minute. I don't think the sexual molestation will have anything to do with any, assuming for a moment it's true. It still has nothing to do with anything except for the penalty phase. If she did it, she's did it, and she's guilty of it. And the
well, then why would he bring it up during the, you know, the opening argument then?
Well,
to try to confuse the jury.
No.
His job is to confuse the jury with alternate choices and to make it difficult for them to make a decision by clouding the vision of the case. And if he doesn't do that, he's being too passive and he's not going to go anywhere with it. And one of the things that all of you missed that I've been looking at quite a bit, I started reading a lot of the blogs that have been coming in on various websites for her. And, you know, I look at this and what I'm seeing is sort of a presumption right now in a country. And the presumption is when you have a child this age and it disappears for a period of time and nobody can really find this child and it shows up dead, the mother is on the hook. And the mother's on the hook for no other reason than she's failed in her responsibilities as a mother. Then you throw in all the different time things that I hear Jan come back to so frequently, and the reality is, yes, this is a problem where she's going to be presumed guilty until she can provide an adequate explanation for why her child was missing for this period of day that does not include her participation. And that is the problem that she faces.
Oh, okay. That's all well and good, except her defense destroyed that strategy by saying, you know, the child died on June 16th, and, you know, that whole month that, you know, it didn't go reported, you know, we have an excuse for.
Well, wait a minute, Simon. That doesn't change anything. The fact is that he has to prove it, and what he says doesn't really matter very much. So, you know, in the end, no one's going to be able to peg the day of death. The jury's going to have to make a decision, and that decision's going to be based on, I don't know what the date of her death is, because no one's ever going to truly know.
This all began with something that one of the people sent over to me. I could read you this statement that was issued to me earlier on and kind of fill in some of those blanks.
Certainly.
All right. A little while back, Cindy Anthony was asked, when did she stop looking for Zandy the nanny? And it was 6 weeks ago. And everybody asked, well, what happened 6 weeks ago to cause her to stop looking for Zandy the nanny? Well, 6 weeks ago, the Anthonys found out from two psychiatrists the direction defense was using the sexual abuse as their defense. The doctors were removed from the defense list without a fight. It appears from that point on that they sided with the defense. This could be true, or this was the only way to give George a heads up on what was coming. His reactions to Baez's statements were too calm, almost as if he knew they were coming. However, unless Lee corroborates Casey's story, this defense will not work. And then Richard Grund sent in he Twittered this out there, and he said this is what he wants to be made known. Someone please explain how we went from an accidental death that snowballed out of control to frame and or implicate the Grunds. He wants that answer now or later on in the civil hearing.
Well, you can't blame him.
I don't blame him at all.
Dave, do you have any input on this one?
Well, you know, there was something that Lippman made a station to, was it Reuters or one of the wire services about, that kind of like said something about her psychological report. But the thing is, I mean, as far as I know, medical records are private. So I don't know what exactly went on there. You know, it's what you really want to believe, I guess.
We're sitting in that courtroom, and you were the father of this child. And the next thing came out of my mouth as the attorney for your daughter and said that when she was 13 years old and bleakety bleak, and you did this and you did that before she went to school, dude, I'm going to tell you what. I would have come unglued, come up out that defense box.
Oh,
and
I
had
would
to,
have too.
The judge had warned everyone that, including the Anthonys, that one peep out of anybody and out the door they go.
Yeah, let me tell you.
I mean, that might have had something to do with his reservation.
Let me tell you something. They would have had to put a bullet in my ass to stop me from grabbing a hold of him and yanking the crap out of him. But he looked down. Everybody says now he's looking down at the little picture of the alien to get his strength. He already knew that question was coming. They already told him.
I believe it, because Mark Lippman did tell Reuters. He said, no, they were not planning on moving out. And I have no idea about Casey's plans other than her psychological report demonstrates
right.
She is deeply disturbed.
Well,
that's
fixed to go down because he was already told that already early on. They got him set up and ready
for
that.
I think you're right. I think they did get him psychologically psychologically ready for that.
I'm right. I wouldn't have said it. I wasn't right about it. I mean, I made bullshit with Manny over there, but I'm a, when I tell you a fact, I'm telling you a fact.
No one makes bullshit with Manny.
I'm going to write that one down.
Right? I mean, he'll come back and bite you.
That's
okay.
The promise.
I want to go to the thinker of the group. Dave?
Well, I'm right here, Simon.
I know it's a lot of volunteers for that one, Simon.
Yeah.
Get him, Danny.
Yes, Simon?
Crime doctor.
Simon,
well,
you have a question for me?
Maybe we should ask the question
for
Simon.
Denny, you've heard the panel speak, and I'd be interested in your comments.
Yes, first of all, I want to say that the Baez statement, the opening statement, got certainly the a lot of attention, and there were words, and not only from. From bloggers or courtroom or trial observers or Casey Anthony Buffs, but from some of these analysts who are on the various TV shows and so on, of jaw-dropping, awesome, bombshell, of course. I was a little surprised. In fact, I got caught up in it, too, because some of them were saying, this case is over. After Baez admitted or claimed to admit that the death occurred on June 16, 2008. It was accidental in the family pool. There was really no criminal activity involved by anybody. Just a tragic accident that snowballed out of control. That, you know, the judge might as well dismiss the jury and everyone go home. And I got thinking right away. I said, well, probably there'd be at least one juror on that panel who will buy into that. And then as I had a chance to listen to the replay of the statement of Baez and to listen to some comments and hear the logic of some other people, I calmed down. I said that this was open statement. None of this is evidence. It's like
right.
I think Cobra and Manny said, these are what they claim they're going to show. But nobody's proved a thing at that point. It was just the opening statement. And I think this trial has an awful long way to go yet. And there's going to be ups and downs, and I'm fearing we're going to get into the dreaded battle of the experts at some point about several of these issues, be it the evidence, be it the sexual abuse or PTSD issues. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that's going to happen. And just take what Clover pointed out, that several of the initial witnesses for the prosecution sounded like they could have been defense witnesses. And that's true, and I think you're going to find the same thing probably later on when the defense puts on its case. You might find some defense witnesses who you think do more damage than good. But I think the prosecution, I believe, had to portray Casey for the lying manipulator they feel that she is.
I'll move for a mistrial.
Pardon me?
Based on your just now statements, Denny, Simon, I move for a mistrial.
Well, I got something, Danny. Denny, I got a question for you, if I may.
Sure.
You know, as much as the prosecution brought out how Casey acted during that month, you know, that the girl was missing, each one of those witnesses also testified on cross or readdress that Casey was a wonderful, loving, caring mother. So, I mean, it didn't all work in favor of the prosecution, wouldn't you think? Wouldn't you say?
No, that's what I say. I said Cobra called it right. He said some of these initial witnesses, you might have thought that they were defense witnesses, but how could the prosecution not? How could they just start out with June 16th and stuff? Could they just start out with July 15th? I think in order to portray Casey as what they believe she was, which is a lying manipulator, that they had to bring in evidence to say that she acted totally normal. There was no signs of grief, no signs of distress, no signs of annoyance, no signs of anger.
And
portray her as this real cold. And to do that, they had to put on these people who were friends. One of them, I guess, the one girl might be an in-law at some point, Lee's girlfriend. So they had to put on these people because they're the ones that dealt with Casey during that time frame.
If I don't let Jan speak, I'm going to be the person in distress.
I'm about to bust here. Okay, first of all, as a mother, I can honestly say this. These people that got on the stands testifying, saying what a good mother Casey had, was, how many times did, other than Mallory, how many times did these people see Casey with Kaylee? 2-3 times. You can't judge that by 2 or 3 times. What mother is going to take their child in front of other people and mistreat that child? Especially these people that she's trying to impress. They're not going to do it. I don't care who you are. You're not going to go and take your child and not be. That baby was taken good care of. She was well-dressed. She was well-fed. But it wasn't Casey that did that. It was her mom and daddy that did it. Okay, and another thing, Baez even himself called Casey a pathological liar. In his opening statement, he said she was a liar. How can anybody believe what she says when her own attorney says that she's a pathological liar?
Well, first of all, Jan, you assumed that she was going to get up and say something, and you're also assuming that she made some kind of confession or some kind of statement that can be construed in that manner, and nothing seems to be further from the facts. And again, you know, it isn't so much what she says, it's the facts. And the facts in this case are really, really against her. So when you look at that, in many respects, it doesn't really matter what she says. It really doesn't. Because at the end of the day, she can't get around certain facts. She has a child who was missing for 31 days while she sort of whistled while, you know, Dixie burned, so to speak. And that's exactly what happened here, is she really did nothing. And it's hard to get around that. So they're going to explain that by the fact that she was a liar. So she, this child was dead, supposedly it happened by accident, drowned in the pool. So it was easy for her to lie without emotion. Is that what they're trying to say? Well, I don't think that if they win that argument's of any value to her. I mean, to prove your client's a liar and that what she did was okay because she basically is a liar, I don't think helps her win the case. And that's the problem with all of this. And I might point out that quite frequently you make a decision as a trial lawyer to put a witness on that normally the plaintiff would, or the other side would put on in this case. And you do it because it gives you an opportunity to ask questions first. And because you're able to ask questions first, you're able to get more things out of them, or you're able to make it look like she's there to help you, when in fact, if the defense calls her, the testimony might be more dramatic in their favor. So some of this is just some posturing and game playing by the respective sides early in the beginning, trying to start off on the right foot. Sometimes they pick witnesses for only that reason, that the same way I once described, you save witnesses for Friday afternoon to leave a bad taste in the jury's mouth when they hear particularly damaging testimony. So in this case, a lot of the reasons for the testimony are reasons that are unrelated to the truth or anything other than strategies, knowing that this is going to come out sooner or later, and you might as well get it out, because chances are what's heard in the first week of testimony gets forgotten after a few weeks. And invariably, juries have to go back after their notes. So they're gambling that people just aren't going to remember a lot of this. And that's part of the strategy, guys. So when you look at this, understand that some of the testimony today is not designed for today. It's designed for tomorrow's events. I hope that
okay.
helps.
Okay. I thought the same way. Yeah, right.
All right. I do have a question. It's a bit of a trick question. I'm pretty certain Dave knows the answer, and I know the answer. Baez came out with this sexual abuse claim, and I thought about it long and hard. It's not part of the crimes that she's accused of. How can they possibly introduce this as evidence? In my simplistic non-legal mind, only three possibilities. George gets up on the stand and says, "Yep, I diddled her," or that's a Cobra quote, by the way. Lee gets up on the stand and says, "Yep, I diddled her," or Casey gets up on the stand, and I think most people are in agreement that the likelihood of Casey taking the stand is somewhat akin to Donald Trump becoming president. It's very unlikely.
I have a better chance of her taking the stand than Trump becoming president.
Right.
Let's call him as we see him. She has a better chance of winning this trial than Trump has of becoming president. That's sad, too.
But, the point is, how can you get the sexual abuse stuff into the trial? It's not relevant, and, most jurisdictions have this thing called hearsay. Well, it just so happens that Florida has a hearsay exception. The deal is that it has to involve sexual abuse. It has to involve a child under the age of 11. And under these circumstances, a third party can tell the story. In other words, hearsay. Do you think that's the route they're going to go? Dave?
Well, one thing is certain. If that's the way they're going to go, then they're going to have to find somebody who Casey told years and years before this accident or murder occurred. They can't just all of a sudden bring somebody out of the blue and say, "Well, yeah, she told me this once." I mean, who came along? Who did she ever? She never brought this up in the past, other than in a letter to Robin Adams, a jailhouse letter, and she said, "My father may have." She never directly accused him of that. So she accused her brother, but Anthony Lazzaro said was that she never basically said anything about her father sexually touching her, and he said he would remember that because that's a hideous thought that he would never remember. I mean, he would never forget a girl telling him something like that. Look at Lee. He does look a little bit on the off side, but George kind of like acts like a handpecked straight up guy. But initially I thought before the defense made their opening statement that that George may have said, "Okay, I'll go with this." Pius says, "You just tell the truth. We're going to make these claims against you that you abused her physically, and that's it. You can still tell the truth." But in the meantime, it pumps the jury with something that they might be able to hold on to, that doubt that he's so looking for. But I think in the end, when Baez went with the sexual thing, I think they really did a bad thing for themselves, because I don't know how they're going to prove it if no one comes forward.
Manny, I have to ask you, because you're the legal eagle.
Okay, you're asking me how I feel about that defense? I just think it has no value, except ultimately if it gets to be an issue about whether or not there's going to be a death penalty. I just don't see any value here.
Yeah, that's what I wondered, yeah.
There's
Major question is, how can they possibly introduce it as evidence in the in the current phase?
Well, it's very simple. First of all, they haven't. First of all, where's it going to? He's got him under what, 776. He's attacking him on cross examination. He has a wider latitude of questions, so he's allowed to ask questions that may not seem like they're appropriate. He's exercised that probably far beyond what he should. But at the same time, the net result is it's not going to go anywhere. The judge is probably going, well, maybe I should strike it, maybe I shouldn't, but it is the defense, and I probably need to give them more of a leeway. So while he's wrestling with it, it got put into evidence. And that's not really uncommon. But the point is, the next time around, the judge is going to say, wait a minute, I let you go the first time, but you didn't go anywhere with this. Where is this going? And unless it's going somewhere that I can see, then all I can say to you is it doesn't work. And I think that's what's going to happen, is there's a little more leeway at the beginning of the case than there is at the end of the case. So that's what you're seeing right now. I just think it's a waste of time, and it's doing exactly what they intended. It's got everybody off talking about it when they should be looking at the other issues. And that's the purpose of all of these various forms of defenses, is to make people talk about anything other than the real issue of the case, which in this case is, did she do it? And because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter to anything other than whether or not you feel sorry for her, that her actions may have been caused by sexual abuse, therefore she didn't have the capacity for first-degree murder. But I got to tell you, one of the reasons that they are putting on some of these various witnesses and friends and saying how wonderful she treated the child, blah, 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 is because that type of evidence goes to the issue of first-degree murder. Because, when you talk about first-degree murder, you're talking about intent, a plan and device. Well, it's hard to prove a plan, but when someone hides the body for a month, you start to infer there was a plan. And that's why they're trying to say, well, everybody panicked, because that's the only way they can get around the fact that there's just no excuse for putting this off for any period of time other than the fact there's a plan, scheme, and device that ultimately turns into, guess what, first-degree murder. And that's where they are. So I don't see this as any value in any respect, other than to get all you guys talking about something that maybe detracts from the real case. That's it. And here we are.
Well, stop and thinking about it. That's the way it's always been. Everything is always, something's come up to distract everybody from the actual thing.
Right. But that's what a defense lawyer does. I mean, that's his job, is to obfuscate, distract, create smoke screens, and do anything he can to make it difficult on the plaintiff, because remember, the prosecution has the burden of proving the case. So all they have to do is block him from proving his case, and they feel like they've accomplished their goal. But, as I said, this case is unique compared to others because of this, what I would describe is this undertone of how do you deal with this subject when the reality is that child's been missing and was in the care and custody of her mother. And when I listen to Jan typifies what everybody feels. It horrifies her that this young child, in a very tender state, was left with a mother who was not the best mother in the world, and she died. And in some respects, people say to themselves, I don't care how she died. She died while living with her mother, and when her mother should have been taking care of her, and her mother wasn't even alarmed that she disappeared for a long period of time. And Jan, am I correct? That just drives you crazy, right?
Yes, it does. That part does, yes.
Yeah, but because of that, there's a natural tendency to say, okay, if that's happened, she has to explain it. So we call it a shifting burden. Normally, there's no shifting burden in a criminal case. This is one of those unique cases that I see very rarely where the burden does shift to one side to explain their conduct. And basically, when I listen to all of you, you repeatedly say that. She needs to explain her conduct. How are they going to explain this? How are they going to explain that? Well, that's the key issue here. Explanation. Now, if she doesn't testify, there's no other explanation than the hypotheses. And you don't win these cases making hypotheses. You win them with facts. So how are they going to put on any fact to support anything they say? And by the way, hearsay rules, the exceptions to hearsay are basically evident in every jurisdiction in the United States. They go back time and time again. One of the key ones, Simon, that you missed in this conversation is called state of mind testimony, that you can put in hearsay not for the proof of the matter stated, but to show the state of the mind of the person at the time. So the issue becomes, did she really believe she was abused? And if she believes she was abused, does that mean that the way she acted was acceptable because she believes she was abused, even if she may not be, and part of her mental illness and all the rest of this is that creating these false beliefs and things that didn't happen. I mean, I can dream up a whole bunch of different scenarios that work, but I emphasize the use of the word dream up, and that's where we are. Everything I hear right now is dreamed up with not one scintilla of proof of any of this occurred in any manner whatsoever. So you need to treat it like that. You need to look at it like that. Okay, so you've said it. What does that mean?
Okay, I'm going to go out to the thinker. Denny, do you have any thinks on this?
Yes, I'm... You know, Kober mentioned early on that he thought that the prosecution may have over-proffered or over-promised. And I think that's the way to it. And like Manny says, okay, that's the defense lawyer's job. Muddy the waters, try to create reasonable doubt, and so forth. But I think I'm in agreement with everybody else that at some point now the jurors are going to expect, I think Manny called it the shifting burden, that at some point now, because of that opening statement and the allegations, and the, you know, had he just, Baez just let her go with sexual abuse, but the old, you know, oral sex implication, and she had to go to school after performing oral sex and George, and then try to act like everything was okay, he went into such detail, I thought, maybe perhaps more than he had to go into, and, if I'm on that jury, I'm going to be expecting before this trial's over with to hear some substantiation of those allegations. And if I don't hear anything, that could affect my attitude because, again, I don't think there's going to be any smoking gun type thing, proof positive, a CSI moment or a Perry Mason moment. But I think there's going to be a cumulative effect of all this stuff. And Casey, I think right now, based on what I listened to the testimony of Cindy Anthony yesterday, and maybe Dave can address this, but I'd have to think if I was on that jury and I'm hearing this excuse after excuse after excuse after excuse of why Cindy can't see Caleb. They're here, they're there, they're in Jacksonville, the nanny's in an accident, the nanny's now going to be admitted to the hospital. She's got to come back and get the nanny's insurance papers. I mean, all this stuff, if I'm there, I'm going to, you know, regardless of Casey sitting there crying at different stages and so forth, maybe to humanize herself to the jury, I'm going to be thinking something entirely different about her when I'm hearing this grandmother and what this grandmother had to go through because of this girl, because of Casey. So, and that's all going to be on my plate. And if Baez doesn't come up with something to show me as a juror that he was telling me the truth or he had some basis in fact for these allegations against George, that's just going to be another nail in Casey's guilty verdict at my end.
I agree. I want to throw in something. I think we're going to save us time. We're going to start calling this the nanny ate my homework defense.
Yeah.
Because that's what it sounds like. When I listen to it coming from you, you know, someone who's just repeating it, it's what it sounds like. The nanny ate her homework, you know, so therefore she's not responsible for anything because, after all, the nanny, you know, like the dog, is responsible. Isn't that the way others feel about this?
Absolutely.
Simon, can I ask?
I would like you to weigh in on this.
Who?
Dave.
Oh, well, I didn't hear my name. Sorry. Now, what? There was a lot said there. You tell me exactly what you want me to weigh in on.
Oh, and anything you like. The Nanny at My Homework story.
Oh, yeah, that. You know what? No, Manny is right. That's precisely what it is. Only it's appearing that Zanny is just an alter ego of Casey. You know, I think that she might have some kind of a Sybil type personality, you know, but it's very difficult to find anyone psychologically impaired, you know, in the state of Florida. But she's certainly got some major, you know, she's really got some mental health problems. And I think what the defense is really going to try and do is prove, I mean, they really proved that's one screwed up family. And I think in the end, if they base what they want the jury to think is that Casey learned to lie from her parents. So
well,
I think that's going to go a long way.
You hear me? Can you hear me, Simon?
I can.
Oh, well, I accidentally got shut off there for a moment, and I've been listening to all this going around. Let's go with the facts that we know first and foremost. Fact one, the child is dead. That's a fact. We have a body. We know the child is dead. Now, what we don't know is who actually killed this child or did this child die of an accident. Now, if you listen to everything that everybody's been saying, the Manny said the nanny ate my homework. It appears to me, I can't put it in the proper vernacular that I need to at this moment, but it appears to me that this young girl could be seen as a robot waiting on the next piece of information to come in. It appears that she is a puppet, that someone is giving her these stories, and she's coming up with all these different angles, and it appears to me. Now, I know a little bit more than most folks, and I'm barred from saying certain things, but it would appear to me that somebody is pulling the strings of this mannequin and orchestrating this from afar, and that's why her stories are changing and she's coming up with different things, and this family is screwed up. And my statement earlier that Lee is going to have to come to the defense and bury Dad and bury a couple of them and the cover-ups, and I'm not really sure which position they're going to take next. But if that puppeteer that's behind the scenes, it doesn't look like this young girl. If I'm sitting in the jury and I'm looking at it now with blind eyes that I don't know anything else, I don't know of the attempts to set up the grunts, I don't know of any of the other attempts to have other people arrested and point fingers at another, I don't know any of that. The only thing that I know at this point is this girl has changed her story. She's working over here. She went over there. It looks like a puppeteer is behind the scenes, and I could tell you that could be Cindy, or that could be George, or that could be Lee. One of these people is behind the scenes giving her the pieces, and she has to wait until the next piece of information comes forward so she can give you the next outlandish story as to what happened to this child. Now, we know the child's dead. That's a fact. But actually, who pulled the string on that mannequin, we don't know. We believe it was her. We think each person has taken it. Oh, yeah, I believe she killed the kid and yada, yada, and why would she have all these excuses? Well, that's why this thing has a twist, like Manny said, to where it can shift, because there may be someone else responsible, and she's the escape goat until somebody else falls on the damn thing. You know, it's your ball. Run with it.
Well, I agree with the extent that, and by the way, I find defenses at times to be very, very fluid. And they're going to change depending upon proof. And that proof, when I say change, also the change is what the prosecution proves. So if the prosecution is successful in proving certain things, the defense will actually switch their defense to something else. So until they put their own testimony on, their feet are not in stone really about anything.
Exactly.
So defenses are very, very fluid, and this one's going to stay fluid because they're in a counterpunch position. And nobody, and believe me, nobody wants to be in that position as a lawyer. I think it's horrible. So what their position is, they have to react to everything the prosecution does, where the prosecution has sort of a straight-ahead approach, and they're just going to put on their case.
Well, Manny, do you see this mannequin effect that I'm speaking of, to where she's coming up with all these different stories? I work over here, the Zanny the Nanny, this, that, and the other. Does she not look like a puppeteer in this, and somebody's really behind the scenes pulling the strings?
Well, I don't think it looks like she's the one putting up all of these thoughts, in the period. You know, they're advanced by lawyers, and people look at what her best available defense is, and basically they fashioned her defense by what they think they've got. And
well, wait a minute. Who came up with the Zanny the Nanny story? Bias?
Exactly.
Cindy.
No, that
Cindy.
Was done before the child was even reported missing. She told all her friends Zanny the Nanny had the baby.
That's right.
Well, that wasn't done by the defense or anybody else.
But who gave her that idea?
She did.
With her own mind.
Exactly.
Yeah, the point, it doesn't matter who gives her an idea, because I don't think the jury really cares about those issues. They care about the truth. And the problem with all of this is that when you have to start switching your defenses, you're in trouble. And, you know, when you have to start finding ways to defend yourself, you're in trouble, because that says one of two things. You had a zero alibi at the time, or you didn't. And the inference usually is you did it. The same way, you know, I hear people sarcastically once in a while say to me, I'm still waiting for O.J. to go find who killed his wife. It's a very valid point when you listen to it.
He can't. He's in jail.
Yeah, well, he had a little bit of time, and... But the point is, nobody can go find anybody who killed anybody anyway, particularly the city size of Los Angeles. They can't find anybody who does commit crimes. They have to put out $1 million, bounty or reward to catch anybody in the city, because it's so damn large and there's so many people, it's virtually impossible to control the population. But the point is not true where she is in Florida. We have a simple case. And I think that Cobra says it constantly. We go back to the same point. There is a child who is missing, and there's no explanation of why this child disappeared and died in the custody of her mother. It wasn't like she was kidnapped, which would free the mother of, you know, some type of liability. Oops, she didn't do it. The child was kidnapped. Not the case. Not the case. Here is it.
Okay. I do want to move on. So far, we've only made it through Tuesday, and not even all of Tuesday. Okay. A quick yes-no answer from the table. Right. After the defense had put up their opening statements, first person the prosecution called was George Anthony. Was this to diffuse the defense's arguments? Dave, your thoughts?
Yes, it was. They
okay.
Basically had no point. No, I mean, that's all they could do.
Right. But likely, he wouldn't normally have been the first choice.
No, he was the first choice because they raised these issues of abuse, right, Dave?
Yes, absolutely. I think they would have started right off slowly, you know, by bringing in Casey's old friends, just the way they did on the second day. They started bringing in people that she knew. So it's going to build up to this... climax when, you know, now the law enforcement people will come in, the forensic experts will come in. But in the meantime, they wanted to set a parameter here that shows that Casey didn't care about her daughter the whole time she was missing. And then what they said about George, they had to come in and deflect that. That's it.
Well, plus they would have lost George if they didn't. I mean, George would have sat around like a teapot boiling over till they finally put him on the stand. That's the other problem. is,
yeah,
you know,
right.
Witnesses get upset and they sit there and they go, she said this, it's not true, when am I going to get a chance to rebut it? And they may have felt they were going to lose control of their own witness or the father and have him a problem in court if they didn't do something to stop this.
Denny, would you concur that it was a last-minute move?
Yes, I thought of. I don't think that was their initial strategy, and I think, to me, it was the right thing to do to defuse that as much as they could, the so-called bombshell statement made by Baez. I think they probably had to do it. I think it was the right thing to do. And I can't help something. I got to ask Dave a quick question here. Dave, you know, there's been some speculation that I've seen that George and Cindy are in cahoots with Baez, and Baez said, look, keep her out of that, getting that fatal injection. You're going to have to take a few hits. You're going to have to eat a little crow. But we can, you know, we can make sure that she doesn't end up in the death chamber.
Well,
and,
you know,
do you sense, based on being in the courtroom, is there legitimate animosity and hostility between George and Baez, or is it a fake? Is it an act?
No, there seems to be a lot of like these two guys do not like each other anymore. You know, I used to see him, you know, when George was sitting on the stand during one of the last hearings when the law enforcement personnel were paraded in. You know, Yuri Melich and Eric Edwards and, John Allen. And then Baez asked that question, would you do anything for your daughter? Would you lie for your daughter? And he said, yes, I would. And that said something to me right then and there. But in the meantime, it doesn't appear like he's lying, you know. I wondered if perhaps Baez said to George, for example, and Cindy, but more George, look, the only way we can get your daughter off is to make this story up about you, okay? You don't have to do anything except go on the stand and tell the truth. I'm not asking you to lie. I'm just asking you to tell the truth. Then it's going to be your word against his. And that's going to open up a door for the jury to look at that and say, well, gee, you know, did he? I don't know. So, in answer to you, Denny, I don't know. The only thing I can say is that there seems to be a genuine dislike now between George and Jose. And I'm waiting to see when Jose cross-examines Cindy, because she's a real tough one, too. You know, if she gets her dander up, she's not. I don't know how she can hold on against a guy like him.
Okay,
they wanted to think that this is the person that was going to rescue their daughter, not just, you know, assassinate them, their character.
Dave, I couldn't help but get the feeling. I was expecting that maybe there'd be some hostility between Cindy and the prosecutor, and I didn't get that sense. Were you there?
No, and I didn't see in the courtroom on Friday. I didn't go yesterday, but I did watch it. But I didn't see George look at Casey, you know, and there were some things that that could have been said, too, that I think that George, if given the opportunity, for example, he was asked why he didn't call 911. He called 911 on the broken shed, cast cans. Well, you know, a person can only take so much from their daughter, and he said, look, I'll give you $10. Leave my gas cans alone. I think he had had enough. And he called 911 because of that. But when the child was, you know, when they found the car and it smelled like there was death and bias, well, why didn't you call 911 at that time? And that really is kind of like a confusing issue with the jury. Yeah, George, why? And this can then lead to implicating him of something. Why would you do it there and not here when you're an ex-cop and you know what human decomp smells like? Why didn't you show any concern? And I think what he should have said was the truth. It probably never came to his mind. But, look, Cindy told me that she's been in contact with her almost every day. You know, so we know that she's right, all right. And she says that Kaylee's all right. So no matter what was in that car,
I can understand why they didn't, what, George didn't call 911 right away. If that makes any sense to you guys.
The only thing that doesn't make any sense to me is I thought this was going to be a simple yes or no answer, so I'm sitting here biting my tongue and wondering what the hell was the question. But my answer is no to that question with a response. The reason that they called George first, because they didn't want to lose their prime witness in primary here, whatever Manny calls that. They didn't want to lose him. Because I think George is about two pills away from killing himself over all this bullshit, because he's part of the cover-up. And if anybody spoke it any truer than Manny just now, you're exactly right. Fuck the gas cans. What about the missing child? He did not do what he was supposed to do then. It goes exactly what Baez said, that he's part of the frickin' cover-up, and there is your answer. Thank you, Manny.
Yeah, I agree. The inescapable fact in this case that separates it from so many other cases is the timeline. I don't recall ever seeing a timeline like this, where there was just such a gap between someone missing, being dead, and the lack of response from the family, and then you get the kind of response that we're all discussing here today. It's just unheard of. Has anyone in all of your experiences in the crime field ever heard of this kind of strange response?
Absolutely not, Manny. And the thing of it was, is I'm so pissed off because I thought there was going to be a reward for those damn gas cans, and then they showed up, and then, you know, kind of took me right out of a job. So that's why I'm about half pissed off. But, you know, the man went to no – I mean, who does that? I mean, I jokingly called Simon the other day as if he was a 911 operator and went through the whole spiel. Yes, I'd like to report my gas cans missing. Nothing else missing? No, just my gas cans. And there was a lawnmower, weed whacker, and all this other stuff. And, of course, he's calling 911 to report his gas cans missing. So, and a piece of duct tape on the gas cans, the fact that he called 911 and made a report on a gas can, come on now. If you can't read past that and know that he knew that these gas cans were somehow part and parcel to the cover-up, and he just, man, I'll tell you what, you don't have to be an Einstein to figure this out. Who has lost a gas can and called 911 to report a stolen gas can when nothing else in that shed, lawnmowers and this and that and the other, in fact, quite expensive pieces, and somebody broke in there and only stole a gas can, and he reports that to 911, yet when his daughter is missing all this time, he doesn't. And I go right back to Manny's story. Manny, you aced it right there, brother man. I mean, you put it right there on the table. And as a jury member, once they come to common decent sense about this, and that's why this week I thought was so funny, because I think, what was it, Tuesday or whatever day it was, we heard effing gas cans from the defense, effing gas cans from the prosecution, effing gas cans from just about everybody. The joke of the day was the effing gas cans. But if you got past the joke for a moment and realized that somebody has contacted the sheriff's office, busy as they are with murders and kidnappings and missing children, trying to report a freaking gas can missing that was amongst a whole bunch of other valuable things, it shows me, George, you're as guilty as the day is long. I don't know if you killed the kid, but you damn sure are in on the cover-up, and I think Baez laid that out perfectly well.
But at the time, he didn't, to their knowledge, Kelly wasn't missing.
So they say, Jan. So they say.
Well, I don't think that they did at that time. I think they knew after, but I don't believe that they did at that time.
I mean, nobody calls 911 to report a freaking gas can stolen.
Well, they might call 911 if their lock is broken.
Yeah, the lock was busted off the shed.
Right.
I mean, don't make it no big deal.
I mean, you know, you can't sit there and change the facts.
The lock wasn't broken. The plastic hasp.
The door on the thing was busted open.
Right, right. So he
said. Well,
says.
So now he had to fix his
shed. No, Tony Lozaro said it.
Yeah,
Tony Lozaro admitted that he got something out of his truck, the tie rod or whatever.
Tire iron.
Yeah, something, and busted it open.
And Tony
admitted that.
And let me ask you a question. Who qualified Tony Lozaro to be an angel to begin with?
I'm telling you, they said it wasn't just George's statement. It was his, too.
The only thing I would say is add Lazaro to the frickin' list of the cover-ups.
Oh, well, boy, now we're going somewhere.
No, no, I don't think so.
Okay, I love it.
Water, for God's sake. I mean, come on, man.
All right. Denny, do you think Lazaro is part of the cover-up?
I don't know. I suppose I'm not convinced right now there's a cover-up. I don't know. I need more information before I make up my mind that there's a cover-up. I suppose if there is one, then anybody could be part of it. And I don't know so far, you know, if there have been any angels.
Well,
maybe.
Well, it could be Frank George is part of the cover-up, too, since he asked about how the shed was broken into.
It, you know, the other thing... That's going to be very interesting to me, speaking of cover-ups, and I don't know if Cobra might comment on this. If there is this cover-up, and it wasn't explained by Baez, at least I didn't hear it, exactly how Kronk came in possession of Kaylee's remains, if there's some evidence to show that there was a connection between George and Kronk, I don't know, cell phone calls, what have you, but anything to tie in where they could make a connection between George and Kronk, there would be something.
There is a connection, as I understand it. And, of course, I was not present there. But it's alleged. And these are allegations that have been made, and I couldn't get a hold of the feller to get some direct questions out of the guy. I did try. I contacted the defense investigators from the other side. In fact, met with one and spent several hours with him. But I could not get a hold of Mr. Kronk to find out because he was too busy selling rattlesnake pictures for $20,000, allegedly. So I couldn't get a hold of him. But it is alleged that Kronk had a girlfriend, a deputy sheriff, female, one each, at the county jail. And apparently when Baez was interviewing his client, she picked up on some attorney-client privileged information, shared that information with Kronk. This is alleged now. Shared that information with Kronk, and then Kronk, along with Dominic Casey, goes to this particular area on Suburban Drive and starts looking for the body. Now, I believe that in August, when they went there, armed with this new information, that they did, in fact, find that body. And I think that the body had not decomposed to a point where the lungs, the tissues, the soft tissues and everything may still contain evidentiary material. So then all of a sudden it was forgave and foregone and looked over until sometime, November, December, when they actually found the body. In this particular time, when he kicked that same bag a second time that he stumbled over the first time, which I don't know. See, I've had the privilege of being in Suburban Drive, and I've been to the actual location. And for someone to go wandering around in there, it's a small, very, relatively small area, and not see that the first go-around, and then the second go-around, kick this bag, and then a little skull falls out. Well, I guess it's time because there's nothing.
I can tell you what I know from being there and taping it, videotaping it, and presenting it on YouTube. You know, I know what happened there. Where the private eyes looked was 175 to 200 feet east of where the body was found, and
so
where the body was found, there's a tree there that you park underneath, and it gives you shade. You know that
right.
One. There's one giant tree that you park under.
Right.
And
that's
why he went there.
Well, I think that's where he parked originally when he went there, and I don't buy into the bogus stories, and I would first have to find out if there's any connection to him and a girl at the jail. And if
Well,
there
who
is,
gave him the body?
Pardon me?
Who gave Kronk the body to begin with?
Oh, I don't know if anybody gave anybody anything, but I'm saying that
if Kronk planned the body, you can't sit there and say you don't know about that. If you're going to make an allegation that Kronk had possession of that body, somebody had to give it to him.
Not necessarily.
True or false? Well, then how do you get hold of the body?
No, here's the deal. I call you up and I say, hey, Bubba,
I got myself in a little jam over here, and I threw this shit out the window on this thing. Go pick it up and throw it out the window on Lee Street, because they're going to find it on Suburban. Go get it and get it over there. So I didn't have to hand you off the body. I mean, this is the defense's the words that they actually gave the body. You can give something to someone without actually being in presence of that something. You can sign a note. You can do something. You can tell someone where something is and have them move it. In a sense, that's giving, or you now taking possession of. But not
so then let's say George held the body last, okay? So George must have known Roy Kronk in order to get him to find the body somewhere so he could collect a bounty or a reward or something. So George just broke himself, gave this to, so maybe Kronk gave George half the money, and that's how he got to go on that cruise.
Well, that's been alleged, too, but who was Kronk out there with at one point in time? He was out there with George's, which is Dominic Casey's investigators, which at the time they were all family friends. You know, they were all friends. They were all friendly fire at that time. Now something has changed, and they don't appear to be friendly fire. But the fact of giving doesn't have to be materialized person to person. It can be done as an arm length type transaction. That's, I think it was a play on words there. That's all.
Hey, Simon?
Manny knows. Ask Manny how you do that.
I want to give my reaction to all this for a moment. My reaction is, who the F cares? She's dead. She's missing all this period of time. And
yeah.
Who cares what they're all feeling? It doesn't explain anything. And it gets us right back to square one. And square one is, this kid's been missing forever, and nobody did a damn thing about it, other than now trying to find some reason why they didn't.
Manny, you spent your life, what, prosecutory, or you're a defense? I mean, you're a defense counsel. Would you not want that as your, you know, one of your chief cases primer, but to go and say, you know, she's dead, but I'm not convinced my client killed her?
Well, I wouldn't do so many of these defenses, frankly. I don't like any of them.
Right.
And if you're going to, the only defense is that she accidentally drowned and I panicked. I didn't know what to do, and I'm sorry I ever did it. And the time to advance that defense would have been when it happened and take the risk of gaining some type of sympathy from everybody before everybody spent literally what seems like, you know, a year or actually a couple of years now making a decision about what was going on.
I would have done that, Manny. I would have done that, sir. I agree, and I apologize. But my mother and my father scared the living shit out of me, and they told me to do this and that and the other.
She's not that scared of them.
Oh, yes, she is.
Okay. Time is ticking. I know Denny wants to jump in.
Yeah, I just want to get everybody's opinion on this. I think one of the reasons this case is getting so much attention, because there are a lot of dead children, unfortunately. It's a fact across the country. There are a lot of children die accidentally or otherwise. And this is getting, I think, so much attention because of the actions or non-actions of Casey and perhaps others after the child went missing or died. The bizarre activity and the fake jobs and Zany the nanny and all this kind of stuff. Now, had this been this accidental drowning on June 16th, as Baez says, Casey, none of this would have come out. In other words, there would have been no investigation. If somebody called 911 at the time and said, hey, we had this terrible thing happen, nobody would have gone to Universal Studio. Nobody would have heard about Zany the Nanny. None of this would have happened. Am I correct there? And first of all, is the reason this case is getting so much attention primarily not because it's a dead child, necessarily, but because of this bizarre activity surrounding the disappearance or death?
You're absolutely right on one side of it there, Denny. You're absolutely right. But the matrix of this family is, first of all, they're not very smart, and they would rather lie than tell the truth. That's one and two. And secondly, the reason it got so damn confused is they probably wanted to call 911. I believe that, you know, my defense strategy would be she wanted to do that. However,
You don't understand the chemistry of this family. They fight worse than a bunch of hillbillies. And they're right in the middle of a choking situation, and damn, they're trying to kill each other. And, I mean, when you put hands on another person in that vernacular, you are already in the midst of a whole drawn-out bunch of bullshit. So then all of a sudden they start, well, we can't call them. Why can't you call them? Can't call them because, hell, we got all this other drama going on. Let me talk for a minute. So one day thinking, two days.
Okay, folks. We are getting dangerously short on time. And, you know, we can argue about, you know, these subjects till the cows come home or until, you know, Casey Anthony lays on that table. But one of the things that we're being asked about repeatedly in the chat room is the makeup of the jury. Now, Jan and I and the rest of the panel have watched this case unfold, but there's only been one person in the courtroom, and that's Dave Neckel. Dave, how do you view the jury?
Me? Well, you know.
I want to know what the reaction to the jury was.
Well, I'll tell you. There's one jury in the back row, third from the right, and he's a younger guy. I think he's a physical therapist, something to do with physical health or something. And I'd say maybe he's pushing his early 40s, late 30s maybe. And when George is sitting on the stand, he sits up and listens intently. And I kind of get, it wasn't me. I mean, I'm sitting there with some pretty important people, you know, from the international, national press. And one in particular brought to my attention, if you look at him, he seems to, like, look at George with a little maybe animosity. But, you know, it's tough to tell. But when there was the young girl, 26-year-old, Maria Kish, when she took the stand, it was like, oh, boy. There were two men in the back row on the far left. I don't know whether they're part of the alternates or not, because they're supposed to be, I think they're mixed up. And boy, did they sit there and look at that girl as she walked up, and then they looked at each other and smirked. So you're seeing, like, what you kind of expect. As serious as this crime is, they're still just human beings. They can write their notes, but they can't take the notebook out with them. After the trial's recess for the day, they leave their pads on their chairs, and then somebody from the court collects them all and puts them, you know, and locks them up at night in a safe. And then they bring them back out in the morning and put them at their seat. But, I mean, the makeup is pretty interesting. You've got a woman in her, I'd say, late 60s. You've got a woman in her 70s. You've got, I think, two blacks, one male, one female. There's a female that the state wanted off the jury, but Judge Perry allowed her. And then you've got, you really have a real mix of people. So,
Dave, I don't want to sound like Nancy Grace, but
no.
I do need to take a call. We have a caller from the 972 area code. What's your name and what's your question for us?
Hi, this is Charlie from Texas again. I called last week. I want to ask Manny. By the way, he is sharp as a tack. Casey should have hired him. She might be in better shape. Listen, they played the tape for Target, Walmart, all the places she went shopping. And then I was like, okay, great. Now next is Amy. They're going to tell about the theft. They're going to tell where she got the money. Nope. They just played it. That's it. So I think the jury is confused. What's that about? She has peanut butter legs, easy to spread, and she likes to shop. That's all they know so far.
I like that.
Not true.
Well, for one, for most men, that's enough, young lady.
But, I got into a squabble over you about men and women and mothers and men. You raised all your kids, you told me.
Yeah, I did.
By yourself.
Okay.
Yeah, I sure did.
Man, before you answer it, I have to tell all of our live listeners, our feed is going to go off in about 20 seconds.
Then let him answer.
Fear not. Everything will be recorded. Okay, Manny, answer away.
Why was there no Amy?
Well, right now, it's so early in the case that all of you are really trying to guess and figure out what's going to come next. And some of this will come next. The question is, what doesn't come next? And what doesn't come next are the areas that can't produce and the ones they have no evidence for. So right now, talk is cheap. And right now, when it comes to opening statement, you get a lot of cheap talk. And that's really the bottom line to all of it, is right now, anybody can say or do anything they want till the witnesses come up. And trust me, the lawyers themselves are not certain what these witnesses are going to say, and may have been surprised by some of the testimony that our listeners are surprised about and on our panelists are. Nobody truly knows what people are going to say. You can interview somebody all day long, and they can take the stand, and some bright lawyer may come up and ask them a question you didn't think of. And then you find yourself going, God, I wish I would have thought of that. And then you hear the answer, and then you go, uh-oh, I didn't expect that either. So there's so much to happen. So that old Rome wasn't built in a day applies to trials. You can't tell your story through one witness. You can't make your point in less than a week in a case this long. And there's going to be ebbs and flows. And this is just one of the ebbs and flows. And pretty soon, some of this will be so far in your rearview mirror, you won't even remember this testimony. And that's the nature of the beast. And I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, you are so brilliant. That's great. And you guys remember the first death
penalty. Will you call my wife and tell her that?
The first death penalty lawyer Jose tried to hire wanted to go the insanity route, and he fired him. Do you guys remember that?
Yep.
And I think that would have been a better choice.
But that
anything
may
was better than Nanny ate the homework.
Yeah, but, that decision may have been made by the client who was unwilling to do that. Someone called me about a case and asked me why something was happening. They said, won't the lawyer stop her? And I go, did it ever occur to you that the lawyer has no ability to stop this particular client, that they actually believe that what they're doing is so righteous they're just going to keep right on going? And I'll bet you the lawyer, and I'll bet you he said to her and even gave her disclaimers that if you follow this particular trend, you're going to lose. But will they listen to her? No. Because to most defendants, it's all or nothing at all. If I have to go to jail, I'm going to go down fighting. And that's the mentality. So bias for...
Quickly. Yeah. Do the jurors get to talk to each other about the testimony that was heard that day? Or do they have to keep quiet until the end?
They're quiet. They're quiet unless the judge speaks to them.
They're instructed not to. And believe it or not, most jurors don't really want to because they recognize pretty quick that everybody listens differently and has a slightly different view and is motivated. And if you're not careful and say something, even including in the jury room, you get jurors that get into fights. So you can't hide it from the judge because it just comes out in the wash, so to speak. So, yeah, they don't talk an awful lot. In fact, the movie 12 Angry Men, the Henry Fonda classic from the mid-50s.
Yeah, that's a dandy.
It's about as accurate about what goes on under those circumstances as any movie you can watch. Because no two people, just listen to your friends. You get your friends around, have someone tell a story, and then somewhere or another your friends start repeating it differently. And one person says, wait a minute, that's not what they said.
That game and, gossip, yeah.
Right. Right, yeah. You experience it all the time, don't you?
Oh, yeah. We played that in junior high school. Mm-hmm.
Right, absolutely. Yeah,
okay.
So I just see that going on more and more and more. So that's what jurors go through, the recognition that whatever they feel, they might just be the only one in the jury that feels that way. So sometimes they get protective, paranoid, and in the end they listen to the judge because they realize that not only does talking endanger the case, but also endangers them.
Well, Linda Drane Burnick tried to bring out the story about the teddy bear. She was trying to let the jury know that Cindy had that teddy bear because she missed Kaylee so bad, and then it disappeared. It meant Casey got back in the house, stole the teddy bear, and kept her from having it. But I don't know if the jury got it or not.
Oh,
I... It's so subtle.
Well,
did they get it?
Okay.
I hate to do this.
But we are getting short on time
okay,
here.
Okay, but thank you so very much for taking my call. Thank you.
Sorry it took so long.
That's okay, honey. My arm's hurting, but I'll
have
it.
A good Memorial Day.
All right,
thank you.
Before we wrap this program up, I have one question for the panel. We haven't seen the defense go after Cindy Anthony yet. That likely will happen on Tuesday. Will Baez try to hang her out to dry as part of the sexual abuse strategy? Jan, what do you think?
I think he's damned if he does and damned if he don't. So it's really a draw. I don't know. I really don't know if he is. I think he'll lose either way with it because he's going to have the grieving grandmother being attacked. I don't know.
Dave, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I think if the defense is capable of putting it to George, they're certainly going to do whatever they can to Cindy. They want to really So they want to make them so that they're no longer credible. That's what they want to do. They want to cast her assassination so that whatever they say, the jury looks at it and says, well, we can't trust these people any more than we can trust Casey. That's my opinion.
Okay, Manny, do you think they're going to hang Grandma out to dry?
Won't know until the day it happens, because to me that's an all-or-nothing strategy. And someone's going to get up on that particular morning and go, oh, my God, if we don't do this, the trial is over right now. And that's basically the big issue. Will someone come to that conclusion, or will they feel that they have no other choice? Because if they do it, they're doing it reluctantly, knowing full well the consequences are pretty much what Jan described, because I agree with Jan. I don't think this is a no-win situation to me. I don't know how you can win with that kind of defense.
Cobra, are they going to string her up?
When they do, I don't know that it'll happen on Tuesday, but when they do, you bet your bottom dollar they're going to bring her. Jezebel's going to show up, and the trial's going to take a whole side road. Watch and see.
Okay.
Right.
And Denny, do you think that's going to happen?
I would not doubt it at all. I tend to agree with Cobra and also with everybody else. I think it's a very dangerous thing, and it's like, you know, playing with TNT. It could make or break. And it would be very. It's going to be very interesting. And the other thing is, will Cindy be able to hold her composure if she is attacked? Or is she more volatile than George?
Hell no. Hell no. She ain't going to hold no composure. And these people like messing with dynamite. Otherwise, they wouldn't have threw George out there. So if they're going to take Granddaddy and say, he's having sex with her and doing all this, y'all get it. Wait till you see what they do to Cindy.
It's going to be an exciting
Cindy
week.
Might surprise us all, though, and go for the defense.
Yeah, we'll watch and see.
Okay.
Watch and see. You're wrong on that one, Jan.
I'm at Gerardo, by the way.
She might.
All right. We are completely out of time. I want to thank our panel for taking part today.
And I still love you, Cobra.
Happy birthday, baby. Make sure that Simon gets lucky.
Thanks. I'll try.
Yeah, it certainly was an interesting program, and I'm sure that there's a high likelihood that we'll be back next week. Till then, this is Simon and Jan Barrett wishing everyone a happy and safe weekend and a great Memorial Day. We'll be back again next Sunday. Till then,
sure.
Goodbye.
Thank you all for being with us today.
Make sure your ceiling fan is connected well.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.